Big banks are making money from new fees on everyday checking accounts, but most banks are not big banks, and many smaller community institutions are still offering free checking for as long as they can. They're hoping to lure customers who are disgruntled with those bigger institutions. Blake Farmer of member station WPLN in Nashville reports.
The news from banks like Regions and SunTrust is arriving in mailboxes across the country.
Let's see what we got.
Big banks are putting in writing what customers like James Miller of Nashville have heard was on the horizon for a year or more. Your free checking account is about to cost you. The research firm Mebs Services found two-thirds of the country's largest banks no longer offer free checking.
You get a letter like that, finally just get to the point where it's like, yeah, it's only $3 a month, but geez freaking Louise, it's $3 a month. Every couple of years, you're changing something and taking stuff away.
Miller, a musician and graphic designer, marched his business from Wells Fargo to a community bank across the street where checking accounts are still free. Smaller institutions see a window of opportunity with people like Miller. Tennessee-based Southeast Financial Credit Union is putting up billboards and sending out letters that proclaim free checking is alive and well. Lisa Reitmeier is the vice president of marketing.
This is when it's happening. This is when it's important and a hot issue to people. So this is when we need to let people know, you know, before everybody had free checking.
It may be free to the customer, but it's not free to the bank that offers the service. Somebody is paying for the service and always has been.
Tim Amos with the Tennessee Bankers Association says for years, debit card fees charged to merchants paid the way for checking accounts. But the recently passed financial reform bill cuts those fees by half starting October 1st, at least for the big boys.
Remember, it only applies, though, to banks over $10 billion in assets, which is certainly all of the larger banks. But it doesn't apply to those banks under $10 billion in assets, which is the vast majority of banks.
Amos says maintaining higher merchant fees for the time being helps community banks keep free checking around. But in some ways, they can't afford the risk of raising fees like big banks can. Southeast Financial Executive John Jakeaway says it would be much harder to recover if customers leave in droves.
We're not able to go out and get any person that walking down the street to become a member of our institution. We're not on every corner across the nation. So each person, each member, if you will, is much more important.
If community bankers can steal some unhappy customers from larger institutions, Sam Allen says they can make free work. Allen is with Renaissance Bank out of Mississippi, which has been promoting its no-charge checking.
By generating more good core checking accounts, that's how we can generate additional fees for the bank.
A survey by Bankrate.com shows most Americans are willing to walk over new fees. Some will take their money to community banks. Others are going to extremes. Waiting at a Nashville bus stop, Karen Rolette says she scrapped Bank of America and now has her paycheck deposited to a prepaid Walmart card.
Yeah, and in today's recession, every little bit counts, you know?
Can you tell me you've closed all your bank accounts?
I've closed every single one of them, yes.
With all the new nickel and diming, Rolette says cash might even make a comeback. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
The military is also trying to make big changes in what fuel it uses. The Air Force and Navy have been testing their aircraft, everything from fighters to unmanned spy planes, on fuel made from vegetable oil or even animal fat. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren took a ride in the cockpit of an Air Force jet flying on biofuel.
Major Josh Fry has been piloting C-130s for a dozen years over Iraq and Afghanistan. On all his missions, the fuel came from one source, petroleum. But on this flight, half of the fuel comes from the seed of a plant called camelina. Fry relays data about how his engines are performing to Master Sergeant Jason Hale.
All right, you ready, Sergeant Hale?
Yes, sir.
Number one, 4260.
Hale's on board to verify that the biofuel works.
Got it, sir.
Good to go?
As we fly over West Texas, Fry takes a few minutes to talk.
I never would have known a difference, to be honest. It flies exactly the same. I never would have known a difference.
That's how all the Air Force test flights of biojet fuel have gone. Jeffrey Braun heads up the Air Force Alternative Fuels Program.
We wanted it to be boring, and it was boring.
So far, the Air Force has approved F-15 and F-16 fighters and C-17 transport planes to use 50% biofuel. The Navy plans to approve all its planes and surface ships to run on green energy by the end of the fall. Braun says when President Bush called on the country to kick its addiction to oil several years ago, the military first focused on turning coal into liquid fuel.
When we first started, nobody had any clue that the biofuels were so close behind. We thought it was going to be another 10 years before we start looking at biofuels, but it turned out it was about 2 years.
High-tech chemical processing makes the biojet fuel nearly indistinguishable from petroleum jet fuel. It doesn't matter whether refiners start with beef fat, leftover cooking oil, or a plant like camelina. Camelina is promising because it can be grown on fallow wheat fields and doesn't displace food crops. Braun says there are lots of reasons going to biofuel makes sense for the Pentagon.
Economically, it could be a real cost saver. Strategically, it would guarantee supplies for our aircraft. And then environmentally, I mean, that just goes without saying.
Studies show fuel made from camelina can reduce greenhouse gas emissions by more than 80%. The Air Force hopes to get half the fuel it uses for domestic flights from alternative sources by 2016. But the small batches of biofuel made so far cost about 10 times more than traditional fuel. Braun says that's a hurdle for Pentagon officials.
They're committed as long as they can get these fuels at cost-competitive pricing. So that means that industry is going to have to step up their production and start creating much larger quantities of fuel.
Well, that's a classic chicken and the egg problem.
Tom Todaro is the CEO of Alt Air, one of the companies that's turning camelina into jet fuel.
To build a refinery at scale is hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. If you don't have known customers, you will not ever build that facility.
Todaro says larger plants will produce cheaper fuel.
We've demonstrated this works. We're going to demonstrate very, very quickly that it's surprisingly affordable.
The military isn't the only potential big customer. Airlines want biofuel too. But Sharon Pinkerton from the Air Transport Association says the airlines aren't in financial shape to back a new industry.
We can't get there by ourselves.
The federal government is stepping in. It's giving incentives to farmers to start growing camelina. And the departments of Navy, Energy, and Agriculture are planning to invest $500 million in biofuel refineries.
To flip the line from Field of Dreams, if the Navy comes, they will build it.
Navy Secretary Ray Mabus says he's often asked why he's such a big fan of biofuels.
The answer is pretty straightforward. We buy too much fossil fuels from potentially or actually volatile places on Earth.
Mabus says this leaves the U.S. military vulnerable. That's why he's committed to getting half of the Navy's fuel from renewable sources by 2020. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News.
Many Americans are finding retirement to be harder than they imagined. That's a finding of a new poll by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard School of Public Health. NPR's Jennifer Ludden begins a series of reports on life in retirement.
Americans pride themselves on being optimistic, but Robert Blendon of the Harvard School of Public Health says it may not be such a good thing when it comes to planning for retirement.
People thinking about retirement, I don't think envision any of the potential problems that they could face. But you have to sort of face up to them, because otherwise it's very hard just when events start happening to respond to them.
The main problems? Money and health. A third of retirees say their finances are worse than before retirement. Even more report deteriorating health. You might ask, aren't these things predictable? Well, the survey polled pre-retirees aged 50 and above and finds they greatly underestimate the chances of either problem.
I didn't give it a lot of thought, to be very honest with you.
Wanda George took part in the poll. She's 71, lives in Las Vegas, and has been retired since a car accident forced her to go on disability at age 59. After raising four kids, George managed a beauty salon and did have a 401k. She says it seemed to be doing pretty well, but after she stopped working, she had to tap into that money to pay for health insurance. She says her late husband didn't put much away for retirement, so she's now getting by only on Social Security.
I had a really nice home. I couldn't afford that. Even going out to eat, it's no longer the nicer places. You go to the cheaper places. Clothing, when you buy it, you have to wait for sales, and which is okay, but you just do not have much of a choice.
Joe Haniak of Chardon, Ohio, did plan well for retirement. A couple 401ks, a pension, he owned a home. He felt in good shape. Of course, the bad economy's been tough.
I think my 401ks are down 20-25%.
Still, Haniak's health is good, but his mother's isn't. So Haniak, at 63, cares for her full-time. As for lifestyle, he sounds like many others in the poll.
Oh, I expected when I retired that I would be able to travel and visit friends. I have friends in St. Louis. I have friends in California. I have some friends down in Florida. And travel is completely out of the picture now. I just can't afford to get away.
Haniak says his mom would need expensive, round-the-clock care in his absence, something his budget, decent though it is, just doesn't allow. Although we think of 65 as the traditional retirement age, by far most retirees today stopped working before then. But the poll by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard School of Public Health suggests a generational shift underway. Harvard's Robert Blendon says pollsters asked people to think back to their 40s and see if they'd delayed the age they expected to retire. Not many of today's retirees had.
But of those who hadn't retired, essentially 39%, or 4 in 10, have moved the age forward that they're going to retire. Over half of them say the lead reason is, I can't afford to retire.
And some say they don't envision ever being able to stop working. Blendon says there's an important message here, especially for younger people.
If you anticipate it, you can do things to try to improve your level of health over time, try to make your financial situation somewhat better in retirement. If you realize that you are at risk for some things actually going worse,
heeding that warning could add a silver lining to feeling pessimistic about the future. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
And you can listen for more Life in Retirement later today on All Things Considered. As the cost of health care continues to rise, people are looking for new ways to cover their medical needs. At a health care clinic near Portland, Maine, the doctors are accepting an unusual type of currency. Here's independent producer Eric Malinsky.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Leslie.
Deb, how are you?
Hi, Deb.
Good to see you.
This afternoon, Deb Barth is going to rake leaves for Leslie Jones.
Everything that you would ever need is in this potting shed.
Excellent.
I'll head back out.
Barth isn't earning money for her yard work, at least on physical currency. She's earning something called time dollars. For every 2 hours that she spends doing odd jobs, she'll earn a free visit with her doctor. As a struggling artist, Barth's income qualifies her for the program at True North, a nonprofit healthcare clinic in Falmouth, Maine. She's one of 33 patients that pay with time dollars there.
I do things like deep cleaning, organizing. I also offer caregiver support for people who may be caring for an older parent.
So how does her doctor cash in on these time credits that he earns? By getting free services from any of the other hundreds of people that belong to the Portland Hour Exchange program. Tom Dahlborg is the executive director of True North. He used to work in Medicaid, where he thought the patients weren't getting enough from their health care.
People would come in for care, and they would be like, okay, give me what you can, that's fine. And they really weren't engaged in it. It was almost like a guilt, like, oh, it's free care, so I don't really deserve that much anyways.
But he thinks the patients that pay with time dollars at True North are fully engaged.
We'll hear from a landscaper who will say, I mowed 5 lawns in the last month so I could bring my children in to see your pediatric nurse practitioner. This darn well better be a good visit.
They certainly get a lengthy visit. Patients are allowed to spend up to an hour or more with their doctors.
They're developing empathy and trust together, which, by the way, is in the Hippocratic Oath. However, most people see that as woo-woo stuff.
They don't just want to get medical information from you. They want to get a spiritual background. It's not like, okay, what's your religion? But it's, okay, what does your life look like? And as a result, I've learned how to negotiate my own health, which has been a huge value.
There's another reason why doctors here think that time banking works well for low-income patients. No red tape.
That's actually not even a small deal.
Therapist Jennifer London has worked with True North and MaineCare, the state's Medicaid program.
For me, the biggest burden of taking, especially MaineCare, is the amount of paperwork and the amount of hoops that need to be jumped through. And I really love that I have a way that I can offer what I do to people who don't have any insurance or are underinsured.
But they can't meet all the needs of their patients. Deb Barth doesn't have health insurance. If she goes to an emergency room or needs to see a specialist who isn't affiliated with True North, she's paying out of pocket. And if her income goes up, she won't even be able to use time dollars at True North anymore. But according to Tom Dahlborg, the biggest problem isn't finding patients that want to take part in the program. It's finding doctors that are willing to go outside the system and barter for health care.
It's still very difficult from a pragmatic perspective to go from a guaranteed salary, where insurance is driving business to you. It's also scary for younger physicians who still have debt load from their education.
The folks at True North know that their model is very limited, but they still hope to inspire other healthcare clinics to consider alternative means of payment. For NPR News, I'm Eric Molinsky.
And you can learn more about True North and the Portland Hour Exchange at npr.org.